I'm Shumit Ganguly, and welcome to Profiles from WFIU. On Profiles, we talk to notable artists, scholars, and writers, and get to know the person behind the persona. Our guest today is Shauna Singh Baldwin, a noted Indo-Canadian author whose latest book is The Selector of Souls. It has been chosen as one of the top 10 books in Canada by the CBC. York University has acquired her papers, and just as of today, we find out that she's been made a juror for the prestigious Giller Prize. It is a pleasure, indeed, to welcome Shauna Singh Baldwin. Shauna, thanks so much for joining us on this show.
Thank you, Shumit.
What I'd like to do at the outset is to provide a little bit of background to your extraordinary career. And to do this, I'm going to provide a little bit of sort of the historical backdrop to novels written by Indian expatriates, by Indian writers in English, and the like. In the immediate post-war era, Indian fiction in English, or those dealing with India-related themes, was a novelty. Indeed, apart from the fiction of Mulak Raj Anand, Ruth Pravar Jabwala, Manohar Malgaonkar, Kamala Markandaya, Santha Rama Rao, and Nayanthara Saigal, Indian writers of international stature in English were pitiably few. Those writing on India-related themes were frequently of British origin, focusing on questions pertaining to the end of empire and issues of race, class, and nationalism. Yet their numbers, too, were limited. Among them were E.M. Foster, Philip Mason, and John Masters. In the last two or three decades, there has been a virtual efflorescence of novels in the English language, both from India and from writers of Indian origin. Indeed, even an aficionado of, like myself, of these genres, finds it hard to keep pace with the sheer volume of work. But what I think distinguishes your novels is that your attention to the granular details of the lives of women in contemporary India. And in this context, I'd like to ask you the first question. What drew you into this life of writing and literature? I ask because only a small number of expatriate Indians, whether women or men, have chosen this calling.
I don't know. I've written stories ever since I was about 11 years old. And, you know, you're told to set these things aside. And, you know, Indian writers are not authors. They're just writers. And, you know, you need to make a living. And so I went all the way through to an MBA at Marquette University and still wanted to write. And at a certain point, I started doing a radio show. And when I ran out of material, I started writing stories for the radio. And so my first stories in English lessons and other stories were written for radio, very short, very tentative, just a scene or two, you know. And when the show went off the air, to my great surprise, people called in and said, why don't you write some more? They missed the stories. And so I sent out that book. And at that time, very few people wanted to publish a book about Indian women in my three countries, India, Canada, and the USA. And so it was only after English lessons became a success, won some awards and everything, that I attempted a novel. And that's how What the Body Remembers came about. So.
Which is an utterly fascinating work on the partition of India and women and men caught up in the maelstrom that befell the region at the time. Mm. One of the things that is really striking about your work, unlike a number of other writers and authors of Indian origin who have expatriated themselves and choose to write about their experiences and those of others, but they mostly focus on their experiences abroad in their home country. Whereas your work mostly, not entirely, but mostly deals with the lives of women in present-day India and harks as far back as the partition of British India. What explains your choice of locales and circumstances?
I follow the images where they are. So if the image comes to me and it happens to be in Kiev or in Moscow, that's okay. If it happens to be in Costa Rica, that's okay. And if it happens to be in the Himalayas in India, then that's where I'll go to get the story. But I trust very strongly in the original images and the consciousnesses of the characters. And pretty often things begin from voices in my head that say, you know, I need to tell my story. And then I have to ask them, what is your story? So it's a very organic process for me. I don't know how other writers, you know, go through this. But The Selector of Souls definitely began from images, and then the research expanded and expanded and expanded because I didn't realize it when I started, but the theme of the book turned out to be sex selection. And so that is a symptom of an underlying misogyny throughout a society. So with this book particularly, it's set from 1994 to 1998, this one deals very strongly with women, but I have written about men as well. And of course, men are easier to write about because there are no reproductive issues involved and there's no pressure on them for caregiving as well as being a person.
This might be an appropriate moment for me to ask you to read a selection from The Selector of Souls to give our listeners a sense or an appreciation of some of the key themes and concerns that animate this particular novel.
Certainly. The section that I've selected to read from is about three quarters of the way through the book. And I've selected it because it is about creating. It is about the feeling of writing. This particular section is, in the novel, it is a spirit possession taking place. But the only way in which I could relate to spirit possession is to talk about creativity. And so this section, which is about page 450, is, in a 500-page novel, is just a little sample. Damini. The drumming grows faster, louder. Damini's bones shift. Her spine tingles and curves into the shape of a sitting cobra. One shoulder is rising, rolling back, then the other. She sways, nods, rocks back and forth, and moans. Men's faces blur. Will the goddess answer her call? Blood and spirit open to rhythm. The air vibrates with the billion vibrations that are rising within Damini. An electrifying charge fills the air, and a billion interconnections seem to happen. Damini can see past, present, and future at once, as if watching a TV. She can smell them too, along with the spore of every body in the room. She is sitting, then standing. Mental and material energies merge. She is splitting. Is this dying? Herself flows out. No, it is that split state she knew in pregnancy, a shifting inside of herself to make way for another, another who watches unseen. The energy of riti, commitments, and connections revolves around her. She draws it in, takes in spirit, offers herself as the vortex of maximum energy, energy that impels her to speak, faltering strange sounds she does not recognize as her own. First syllables, then words, then phrases, not her own, not her voice, not her speech, but a lost language from a time before time. Damini's arms flail. She is shaking, trembling. She does not recognize the voices, but senses sound, intent, and a white heat rising from her womb to energize all matter from the very smallest particle to the whole. Who is it who comes? Blood beats at her temples, beats to the drumbeat all around, making connections for which, as yet, there are no names. The unseen is not asleep or simple, but demonically active. Familiar asuras snap inside her. Demons with long fangs. Now outside, frothing, they seem to rake her flesh with blood-tipped talons, unexplored angers, angers swallowed and digested, along with every fear she's ever given herself, is incarnated in these hungry ghosts. And they in her. They have lived within Damini. From the time Damini was first taught, she didn't matter. They have sucked in every need Damini ever suppressed, every want that became don't want, Every word she ever believed insignificant, every insult received, they swirl up from karma she has not expiated and orbit the room. They roar as they devour the present and the past. They command her breath, speak with her mouth, gesture with her arms. They will touch her future if she gives them power. She opens herself to Stri Shakti, and the asuras of fear subside.
Well, that's a marvelous selection. In case you're joining us, I'm Shumit Ganguly, and this is Profiles, and I'm speaking to the Indo-Canadian writer, Shauna Singh Baldwin, particularly about her new book, The Selector of Souls, and also about her work in general. Speaking about your work, there are two things that strike me amongst a host of others, which I hope I will be able to return to, other issues that I'll be able to return to. But two things are particularly striking about your work, other than, of course, the focus on the lives of women, their aspirations, their hopes, the difficulties they encounter in different circumstances, their treatment at the hands of men. But your work is both historical and anthropological. Would you like to shed a little bit of light? Because not every novelist takes history and anthropological circumstances as seriously as you do.
I guess I'm just interested in the context of people and how economics drives so much of our lives, you know? So a large part of the misunderstanding of one culture by another is that we really don't understand the history or the economics of how people are constrained to act for survival sometimes. And so we make choices even if we think that we are determined, you know? And so I'm very fascinated by the fact that people, even when we think they have no choices, still make choices. And when they are faced with obstacles and a virulent society of misogyny, they still find a way to move past the obstacles and in ways that are very inventive, in ways that we would never consider in North America. And I admire the women of other countries for that. And I think that that's a beautiful thing that we should celebrate instead of looking at women in other countries with some sort of pity. I think we need to look at them with empathy. And so I'm hoping for that kind of reaction from the reader. And that leads me, obviously, into history, politics, economics, you know, many things that I probably shouldn't address, you know, if I knew what was good for me.
One of the more fascinating things that I find about your characters, particularly your women characters, they are not mere objects of pity or helplessness. They are very much agents. They may be faced with extremely adverse circumstances, but they don't just simply let those circumstances steamroll them.
No, I've never met a passive woman in my life. Have you?
A few.
A few? Well, they're not very interesting if they're passive.
No.
You know, and I do find myself very drawn to women who take action. And maybe some of them are manipulative rather than, you know, in your face. But they still take action whenever they can and in ways that we wouldn't think of.
And even this encompasses women who you would normally think are simply going to be marginalized because of their status in society, because of the ascribed status that they face. Take, for example, Damini. Mm-hmm. Damini could very easily say that this is my lot in life and I have to accept this is my bhagya, yeah, as she occasionally says.
Yes, just to set a little bit of the stage, though, I should explain that Damini,
yes,
is about 50 years old. She was a maidservant, yes, in Delhi, and then she has moved to the Himalayas and she's trying to, she's broken a terrible taboo, that of living with a daughter. And so she has to make compromises as a result. And so the book begins with a terrible crime that she commits as a part of her survival strategy. And then the rest of the book is about how she recovers from that. So yes, Damini is faced with many moral choices. And I think we have those at every moment in our lives, but she's very inventive as to how she gets around things.
Yes, from dealing with the local tea stall owner to dealing with the very irate son of her employer.
Yes.
I mean, it's really quite remarkable how she manages to maneuver through very difficult circumstances.
Yes, yes.
I think the same is true of other women characters also. The young woman who is the second wife in the in What the Body Remembers, mm-hmm. who then comes back in The Selector of Souls almost, 60 years later?
Yes, yes.
She's also a survivor.
She's a survivor.
Would you like to say a little bit about her for our audience? Because
yes,
I think
certainly.
That she's an intriguing character.
She is, and a beloved character now. She, Roop is the Shiro of What the Body Remembers. And she is modeled on my grandmother. But interestingly enough, when the book came out, I was petrified that my grandmother wouldn't like it or something. But my grandmother said to me, she says, Roop is not me, though, she says. Is she you? And I said, no, she's not. And she says, you know what? She must be both of us. And I said, or she must be herself. And I think that that's more accurate now, that Roop has become a character in herself, and she is much greater than her author or her model. And she was a 7-year-old little girl when we first meet her in the book, and she becomes the second wife of a very powerful Sadarji in Rawalpindi before partition. So she is modeled on my grandmother, the dates of her life, for instance. So we meet her in 1927, she gets married in 1937, and then the book really goes from 1937 all the way through the partition of India in 1947. And like my grandmother, Roop becomes someone who is, subjected to surrogacy, where her children are taken away from her and presented to the older wife as hers. And so she's brought into a household as a second wife, but, you know, her children are supposed to be belonging to the older wife. And this was done, you know, very often in that era. The difference with my grandmother and with Roop in the novel is that her children are actually taken away from her geographically as well and given away in front of the Guru Granth Sahib, which is the holy book of the Sikhs. And this is very, very difficult for her. But all three people are explored in their reactions to this: Sadarji, who's the husband, and the first wife, Satya, and Roop. So all three have their say in the novel.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm wondering if there's another layer of meaning here.
Great layers of meaning, absolutely.
Of her inability to hear, because
yes.
There are certain things that are told to her.
That she won't hear.
She won't hear.
She refuses to hear, and she turns her face away when she doesn't want to hear, because she will not lip read the things that she doesn't want to hear. So that also is a survival tactic.
It's a very selective hearing.
Very selective hearing.
You know, I really didn't hear you.
Really did not, no.
But there are multiple meanings embedded right there in that I really didn't hear you.
Absolutely.
And this continues well into The Selector of Souls.
Yes, yes.
It's not just in her early life or in her early married life as the second wife, but in her incarnation as a grandmother.
Yes.
One of the things also that is quite striking about your work is the while you do depict human harshness and cruelty and human injustice and callousness, all of which you forthrightly tackle, you also tackle things of extraordinary tenderness, which is just, there are passages in both novels that are so incredibly moving. Amidst all this pain and suffering which you deal with, you also find moments of great human warmth, connectedness, and affection.
Certainly, but we find that in life, no? I find that even yesterday on campus. You know, I was taking a walk late at night, for instance, and there was a woman who was walking down the street in front of me, and she was in tears, and I could hear her, and I followed her. And I thought, what is the matter? What should I do about this, you know? And what is her story? And she stopped and we talked. And it was in the middle of the night on campus and we hugged. And that was, for her and for me, just a moment of connection. And it was the middle of the night. I didn't know her. She didn't know me. We'll never see each other again. But it is for those moments that we live and we know each other as human.
One other theme that seems to cut across your novels also is the idea of human separation, and particularly forced separation.
Yeah.
Forced by a set of circumstances, forced by family. And here you find a peculiar intermingling. On the one hand, the extraordinary pain brought about by separation, but also a sense of longing and a sense of attachment because of the separation. And you deal with these contradictory sentiments,
yes,
and emotions with remarkable skill.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad you got that. I feel very strongly that the things that separate us can also bring us together, you know. And I have, in fact, a novella called The Distance Between Us about a gentleman who discovers a daughter from a green card marriage late in life. And it really is true that all the things that we think separate us could just as well bring us together if we would allow them. And I love that paradox about life. And I also think that it is part of being in the diaspora that gives me that kind of vantage point to be able to examine the distance from India, for example, and what it creates in a second generation person like myself. You know, I was born in Montreal. I really am not authorized to to write about India from the how dare you factor that creates, you know. But it is a part of my life. There's no way I can get away from it. And at the same time, there's this love-hate relationship that every NRI has with India, or every second gener has with India, because you cannot distance yourself from it, and you cannot separate yourself from it, but you don't want to either. You know, it's your source of strength as well. So there's always that paradox that is so wonderful and so horrendous at the same time. Do you experience that too?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And the whole issue that you very correctly point out, which often many anthropologists face, and not just anthropologists, people who do field work face, you know, how do I locate myself?
Yes.
I am both an insider and an outsider.
But as a writer, that's a good thing, because you need to be able to get inside somebody and you need to be able to stay outside as well. For the reader's sake, but at the same time, not to take a story and just say, well, I'm just here for the story. For instance, when I was writing What the Body Remembers, yes, there was a whole memoir that I wrote with my grandmother, and that is a family document, and it's hers in her voice and everything. So that was writing two books at the same time. The interview process for the memoir was completely different from the process of writing. So to write ethically, I think, about anyone also means to let them speak. Let them speak through you, perhaps, but let them speak. And that's why I was reading this particular section, which is about spirit possession, because you are the mouthpiece in so many ways as a novelist, much more so than someone who's writing nonfiction, you know. You are the mouthpiece, and you have to let it come through you, because that's the only way that it will become more than you.
For those of you who are joining us at this moment, I'm Shumit Ganguly. This is Profiles and on WFIU, and I'm speaking to the Indo-Canadian writer Shauna Singh Baldwin about her many novels. And one of the novels I want to return to again was written in the late 1990s, What the Body Remembers. One of the most striking features about this novel is that it deals with one of the most horrific events of the 20th century. Not very many people are aware of this outside of the subcontinent, sadly. Millions of people perished. Millions were displaced. It scarred people on both sides of the border in India and Pakistan. People continue to live with those scars and in many cases nurture them.
Mm-hmm.
amongst the many things that I find appealing about this book, but one of the things is your unsparing honesty. And this goes back to just our previous conversation about having a degree of distance. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you can comment on this, elaborate on this a bit more.
Oh, I think writing is such a humbling experience. It teaches you that you have to show both sides of a situation. And I may start out with an opinion that is exploded by the end of my writing. So that's part of the attraction to writing, is that it will open me up. It will crack me open. And unless I crack myself open, how can I expect the reader to do so? So I have to see the other side of every situation. It is a reconciliation of opposites, after all, to write any story, whether it's a travel piece or whether it's a magazine article or anything. There's always something that the protagonist has to face and overcome. So from that standpoint, there's an antagonist also whose point of view has to be shown. Now, I may not like that, as in The Tiger Claw, for example. In The Tiger Claw, the antagonists were Nazis. And the particular Nazis in The Tiger Claw, I had to write some things that came off my pen that I did not agree with one single bit. But for the protagonist, for Noor Inayat Khan, who is a historical figure, to have a reaction, I had to write the opposing side. So in that, I taught myself a lot about how an Aryan supremacist thinks. I taught myself a lot about how to recognize the idol worship of a flag, for example, and to recognize it in other contexts as well. So I grew from that, but only because the writing process taught me something.
Though the interesting comparison with The Tiger's Claw and What the Body Remembers is the following, that in The Tiger's Claw, there are obviously evil people. The Nazis, it's very hard to put a gloss on them.
Yes and no, because the characters in The Tiger Claw still show compassion. And that's a very interesting point, because Hitler tried so hard to root out compassion.
That's
and
correct.
He was not successful. Right. And so even in The Tiger Claw, you do see these moments where even a Nazi has a certain amount of compassion, or obsessive love in the case of one of the characters. And it changes the story as a result, that compassion.
Well, that's a very delicate subject to handle.
Very delicate.
I mean, it's a very fraught matter.
It is.
But in the case of What the Body Remembers, it's much more complicated, because you don't want to simply pass judgment and say, well, you know, the Muslims were really responsible, or the Hindus were responsible,
right,
or if it only weren't for my own community, the Sikhs, everything would have been fine.
Right.
Instead, what you try to do is to show that these are groups and individuals caught up in sort of titanic, cataclysmic forces, which they don't wholly comprehend themselves.
No, and we are more than our group identity.
Precisely.
And that is something that we have to learn as a people. And I mean this from the standpoint of being Indo-Canadian, as well as being Indo-American, as well as being, connected to India. Our problem is always that we are too much identified with our group. So even if I show generosity sometime to somebody, oh, you're so Punjabi, you know. So even your good characteristics are considered part of your group identity. So my challenge to myself is to show, and this is why the novel is such a great form in which to do this, is to show that we can be individuals, that we are not just our group identity. And currently, this is becoming very important because, of course, we have a mindset that is beginning to look at minorities as just their group identity and not as individuals.
Yes, I think that is a very compelling point and well worth making. Once again, I'm your host, Shumit Ganguly, for Profiles from WFIU. And I am speaking to Shauna Singh Baldwin, a noted Indo-Canadian author whose latest book is The Selector of Souls. But we've been talking about the book and other pieces of her work. And what I want to do now is turn to one of her earlier works, which we have discussed, What the Body Remembers, about the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947. One of the more striking features of this book also is your attention to the particulars of village life around the mid-century. Social mores, social customs, rituals, practices, beliefs. How did you manage to recreate this world with such vividness?
Well, the challenge about writing about the partition is always that the stories have come to one side of the border and the setting is left on the other. So I grew up with the stories. 40% of Delhi, when I was living over there, was composed of refugees from the partition. So I knew the stories, and I knew my grandparents' story. But when I went to Pakistan, I went in 1997 with my husband, my Irish-American husband, and he was actually very happy that everything around there was green. He thought it was Kelly green. And so I said, no, it's not Kelly green. It is Islamic green. And it was very interesting traveling in Pakistan with him, too, because he had a very different point of view as we went through the different little villages and interviewed people. So I went to Pakistan to understand the setting there, and it is very different from India. It is camel country, and India is elephant country. So just from that, you can understand how different it is. And the Patwar Plateau, where most of the story is set near Rawalpindi, is a badlands kind of area near the Salt Range, for instance. Very different from anything I'd ever seen in my life. So to become lyrical about that is very easy. So much of the refugee longing for that was in my blood, you know, because I'd heard the stories. So
let's talk now a little bit about a totally different kind of novel, The Tiger Claw, which again deals with historical circumstances but is focused around one individual and her rather unusual life.
Yes.
What led you to her and to write, to weave an entire novel around this historical figure?
Yes. My husband and I own an espionage-themed restaurant called The Safe House in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And one of the people who we met over there was a former spy in World War II. His name was Gaston Vandermeersch. And at the time, he was writing his memoirs, and it was called Gaston's War when it came out. But in researching Gaston's War, he ran across the story of Noor Inayat Khan, and he sent me this information and said, you're a writer, you should write about her. You know, she was a princess in the 1940s. And I said, yes, Gaston, every Indian woman was a princess in the 1940s. And then later on, we all became computer programmers. And now, of course, we're all novelists. So yes, I'm sure she was very interesting. And he said, no, you have to listen to the story. Here, I'll send you some stuff. And he photocopied things, sent me things, and I read what had been written about Noor Inayat Khan, and I thought, this is terrible. I have to rewrite this story. It was written with such Orientalism, and, you know, painting her in such overly sexualized terms. I mean, the poor woman, her actuality was probably gone. So I did it kind of as a remedial situation, you know. I remember touring France at the time for Belle Etrangere with Shashi Tharoor, and I told him what I was doing, and he said, oh, you beat me to it, because he too had, the ability to speak French and to read in French and to read the history and everything and to write the story. But he said, oh, but you'll bring a female view to it. Well, I thought, well, how does that make it different? You know, you would write the same kind of book. And then as I got into it, I thought, no, I do bring all of the feminine to this particular story, because you could not ignore the fact that, for instance, in her biography, she'd had a stomach operation in the 1930s. You could not ignore certain things that were in the actual biographical material that had not been explored, areas of silence And the areas of silence are what draw you in as a novelist. That's where your imagination can go, you know?
Absolutely. You can sort of embellish right, and embroider. Right.
And plus my husband's library of collecting spy books for the last 40 years was available to me, and he has about 1,000 spy books. So I could have been working on that forever, you know? But it actually came to life in a beautiful way when I had a frame story, and the frame story is about Noor Inayat Khan's brother, and she has two, so I did something that was completely fictional, which is great, to make sure that, you know, no living people were portrayed in the novel.
And if I'm not mistaken, it's about to be made into a film.
Yes, it is, and starring Lisa Ray, so that'll be very nice.
You might want, for the benefit of our listeners, you might want to say a word or two about Lisa Ray.
Lisa is half Bengali, half Polish, and very attracted to the story because, of course, like Noor, she is mixed race. So I hope that that this movie will be made with her in the lead. Yeah.
I want to turn now more to the modern world, mm-hmm. and more specifically to the milieu that you create in Delhi, in your latest novel, The Selector of Souls. Mm-hmm. It is like virtually walking through that world when I read it.
Well, thank you.
With sort of upper middle class India, especially the nouveau riche in India, with all their foibles, all their quirks, all their angularities on display. And it's almost like having a mirror held up in some ways, because I have seen that world. And your reconstruction of that world is almost, again, like it's almost ethnographic. Is this largely from recent experience?
Not really. The story that began The Selector of Souls was actually written in the 80s. And there was a character from that story that kept coming back and saying, it's not finished. And that story was in English lessons. And it was a long story in English lessons, so I thought I had done justice to it. But the story in English lessons is called A Pair of Ears. But the character, the minor character in that story, kept saying, well, what about me? And that was Damini. And so because her voice continued to bother me, I went back to A Pair of Ears and moved the story to the 1990s. And it's only when I moved it to the 1990s that it took off, because that was a moment of change in the culture, in the whole way in which society was moving. And all of a sudden, we were in a different era, and it was, I had to imagine how it might have been, because I didn't live in India in the 1990s. So I had to interview people, and I had to talk about what were the changes that took place after the 1991 opening to the West. How did that affect you? What are the, not just the economics and everything, but how did it change relationships? Well, one of the things it changed was the property values in Delhi. And as a result, many people went through a complete inversion of the social contract between one generation and the other. And so the book begins with an elder abuse situation and then, you know, continues to go downhill from there.
Yes, it does go downhill, even when we are in the mountains.
Even when we're down in the mountains, that's right. But you know what? It's, again, it's not what happens to you. It's how you react to it that's important. And I just love the way people react to these terrible things that are happening, you know. I mean, you could commit suicide, but why? When you can do such and such, you know? I mean, and there are people in the book who consider committing suicide as a result of domestic abuse, for example, or as a result of something else. But they continue to go on. And that is always the question that one must ask in life. Why do I not commit suicide? You know, what is it that gives my life meaning? And it is from that question that you can find something. And in every book, I've tried to make the antagonist of one book the protagonist of the other. So from What the Body Remembers, where the antagonists were Muslims, then the protagonist of the next book becomes a Muslim, right? And then from that, a Christian protagonist was necessary for the third book. And so I have Anu in the Selector of Souls, and she is a half Hindu, half Christian woman who then becomes a novice in a convent. So there's the Hindu versus Christian conflict in the third novel. So I guess I'm working my way through all the religions, but
there are two things that flow from this conversation about the Selector of Souls. One is, as you said, the breakdown of this social contract. And accompanying this breakdown of this social contract is also a willingness to flaunt wealth, which old wealth in India really had a sense of rectitude about. There was a sense that, you know, it's really not appropriate to engage in this sort of show of wealth, this form of ostentation.
Right. And there was a sense of noblesse oblige, you know.
You took the words out of my mouth. Right. That's the second thing I was going to focus on. That the sense of noblesse oblige really is shattered in this novel.
Yes, it is. And part of that is that, you know, all the things that were important before, such as altruism as your motivation for action. You could always say, I'm not doing it for myself, I'm doing it for others, and that would be a really good excuse for whatever you were doing, which is also overused, and you know, we have our own problems with that. But that was a good excuse in Indian society for anything you wanted to do. Today, a good excuse for doing anything is I want to do it. And so there's a complete inversion of what used to be the ethos of a whole society. And so the kind of antagonist in this novel is an ad man. He is an advertising person who promotes desire. And desire, of course, is the one thing in both Hinduism and Buddhism, well, partly in many of the faiths in India, that is considered, it is really bad. But in modern India, to say I want is absolutely a good thing. And especially anything that you want should be a thing. So it has reduced everything to a commodity. So even love and babies and motherhood are all now commodities.
And nowhere is this more manifest in your creation of Swami Rudraksh.
Oh, yes.
Who is a loathsome individual, and unfortunately, all too real. This is not some, you know, character that you've conjured up and really doesn't have much connection to reality. Quite the contrary.
No, the Godmen are a dime a dozen, and they have no investment. They have no customer satisfaction required. They have no inventory to maintain. They are funded beautifully. You know, they have a great business going.
It's a wonderful business model if you can get it to work for you. I particularly liked his insistence on sitting on sheepskin.
Yes.
You know, nothing's too good for the Swami. And the blatant contradictions of his professed philosophy, which you just sort of, you know, pull the rug out from under him on every occasion, very mischievously.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, quite frankly, I think he gets what he deserves in this. But the portrayal, I mean, it's uncanny.
Well, thank you. You've seen a lot of these people.
I have.
Okay.
And that's exactly why I find it so uncanny. And what is, instead of a genuine attachment to notions of spirituality and transcendence, which characterized another generation, where you could say those beliefs are irrational from the standpoint of the modern world, one could sort of be dismissive, you know, or some people could be dismissive anyway. Yeah. But there was a certain genuine attachment, a genuine sense of faith.
Yeah, and a genuine warmth and feeling of understanding and trying to understand the creative mind.
Precisely.
Know? Yeah.
And here, it's nothing more than sort of hucksterism.
Yeah, yeah. And magicians work very well over there.
Yeah, these are thaumaturgists, basically. Yeah.
Mentalists, magicians.
Right.
These are, that's what they would be called in the West. But,
right.
But in India, mentalists and magicians are, you know, revered as godmen.
Yes, with this kind of superficial gloss around them, mouthing a whole series of platitudes, which seem to offer some superficial comfort.
Yes, and the comfort factor should not be ignored. And I think that that's really, really important to understand the call of that comfort factor. And I'm not in the camp of the Dawkins and the, you know, the atheist writers, mainly because I feel very strongly that comfort is so important for religion to offer. And so I'm not so down on it as most people. However, you take the virulence of this particular kind of hucksterism and you attach it to something that's supposed to be about comfort, and it takes on a completely different cast, a way that Hinduism was never meant to go, or a way that if it happens in Sikhism was never meant to go, or if it happens in Christianity, it was never meant to go that way, because nothing really can be done about it when it takes on its own idol worship, worships itself.
Yes, and I also noticed this very respectful attitude towards faith that you have, which is manifested to some degree in the character of Father Prashant.
Yes.
Who, I won't say anything more, lest I give away too much of the story. And yet it's not an uncritical eye, because you recognize that Father Prashant may be an utterly sincere and decent human being who's trying to exemplify certain values, but he's not without his flaws either.
No, he can't be. Nobody can be. You know, we all have our flaws. And I think the paradoxes within people make them interesting. And, you know, eventually he's modeled on, for instance, the Graham Staines case. You might have heard of that.
Of course.
Yes.
The poor Australian missionary who was burnt alive.
Yes, but he was not Catholic, though.
Right.
But in the case of Father Prashant,
he is Catholic. Right.
Yeah, and he is Jesuit. Yeah. And I've known a lot of Jesuits in my time and admired them tremendously. But there is one particular Jesuit on who Father Prashant is molded. And Father Cedric Prakash is his name. And I love him dearly. And I hope he loves the book too, but I don't think so, because eventually, unfortunately, he has problems, you know, in the book that poor Father Cedric should never have.
Yes, so. That, and also you don't shy away from the problem or the issue of Catholic dogma over abortion.
Correct. Yeah.
And that's a very fraught issue in India, and you deal with it forthrightly.
You have to, because it affects us. You know, what we think about the afterlife and what we think about birth are going to affect our future as a planet. And eventually in this novel, we move towards the nuclearization of India. And you cannot separate reproductive politics and the rise of the testosterone generation of little Maharajas from the eventual nuclearization in 1998. Now, I'm going to turn the tables on you a little bit and quote from you, okay? Does one care more about what actually happened in the past Indo-Pakistani confrontations or what could happen? That's from your book.
Yes, it is.
It is, right? And in this book, in The Selector of Souls, I do care about what could happen. And what could happen, given the fact that we have two nuclearized nations standing across a very thin line of control, two very different faiths driven by sex selection, son preference, little Maharajas on both sides, you have very tinderbox situation across that divide. So part of what the connections that are made in the Selector of Souls are from this horrible misogyny that's at the base of sex selection, to sex selection, to the fact that it leads to certain behaviors in men that are the performance of masculinity, and from that to nuclearization. And I think that is where the book led me and the writing process led me, but I hope that it serves as some kind of an understanding, really, of what we have to fear in the years to come.
The misogynistic character of Indian society that you portray in this is done in a remarkably subtle fashion, in that you do not in any way implicate one community with a greater degree of misogyny than another. This mm-hmm. is something that sort of cuts across.
It does, partly because the legal system cuts across everything, and it privileges the man as the head of the family, so that by definition the woman becomes secondary. That's one part. And the other part is always that whenever you complain about anything, and as a Sikh woman, I can complain, for example, that the scriptures say I have full rights, and yet I don't, you know, in practice. But whenever you complain, somebody's always got it worse. So be glad you don't live in Saudi Arabia. Be glad you don't live in Pakistan. Be glad you don't live somewhere else, you know. And be glad you don't live in North America, is what the Indian woman is told, because then you won't have servants, and then you won't, you'll have two jobs to do, not just one at home, you know. There's always some place that you are not, that you should be very grateful that you don't live over there if you are an Indian woman or in any way connected to India.
That's often a trope that people resort to as a way of sort of dismissing very legitimate concerns that are expressed.
Right. But you know how Indian women get around it?
No, this intrigues me. Do tell me.
Well, you'll have to read The Selector of Souls.
I have, actually, with great care.
I know, but you'll see from that. I'm addressing that to the listener.
This is
more
really
than
for the audience. Right. Exactly.
But no, in The Selector of Souls, I think they get around it by talking about duties, not rights. And that change of frame, you know, reframing everything in terms of duties, suddenly changes the picture. And it is a discourse that is unrecognizable by a North American woman, because we talk about rights in this country. And this is our language of framing anything. It is about rights and competing rights and conflicting rights. But none of that is spoken about in a dharmic society. A dharmic society is a society based on duty, based on position, based on your role in the movie of your life. And so in Damini's case, she believes she's in a movie of her life, you know, but she doesn't actually think it's about her until the end of the book. And in doing that, she also uses this language of duty, which is from feudalism, which is not from democracy, but is still pervasive in her culture. And she uses that language to change people around her.
Now, this sociological perspective, I think, is very important to bear in mind, especially when one thinks about this novel or reads this novel with any degree of care, because this whole difference between the notion of rights and the notion of duties, these are two very different sociological constructs,
yes.
But they animate different societies in markedly different ways.
Markedly different ways.
And it's sort of shot through the social mores that permeate these societies. Our time is rapidly coming to a close. I'm Shumit Ganguly, and on Profiles from WFYU, I'm speaking to the Indo-Canadian writer Shauna Singh Baldwin about her various novels and her vast literary output. I'm going to try and conclude this interview by turning to a question which sort of transcends a number of your novels, and particularly two, both of which we have talked about at great length over this past hour, and that is What the Body Remembers, dealing with the partition of the subcontinent, to The Selector of Souls, dealing with sex selection and its horrific consequences in modern India. In the first novel, even though it deals with one of the great tragedies of the 20th century, there's still a sense of hope, there's a sense of warmth, there's a sense of things might actually get better, even though we are caught up in this maelstrom that has gripped us at the moment. But in The Selector of Souls, there's a much more of a jagged edge to it. Mm-hmm. It is fraught with pain. It's fraught with suffering. And you're almost afraid of turning the next page because of what it might bring. It's pregnant with possibilities which could be deeply and profoundly disturbing. And even the end, you leave us guessing about what finally transpires. And I'm not going to describe the end for fear of ruining the experience for many, many readers to come. But even in the end, I'm sort of left dangling. Yes. And dangling in a way that I don't particularly find comforting.
No, you shouldn't find it comforting. Kafka said that a novel should break open the frozen sea within us, should be like an axe that breaks the frozen sea within us. I'm not quoting it quite right. But I hope that that's where this novel leads in terms of really reassessing the moral choices that we make, and also offering a need for discussion. Because whatever you think about the ending, I hope that it will motivate you to discuss further. And my editor at Knopf Canada says it's a book club ending, because you want to get together with other people to discuss it. And that is, I think, the idea behind the inconclusiveness of it. Even I don't know what happens, okay? And so don't call me at 3 a.m. about it, because I really don't know what happens. And that's really the draw of writing about India, too. We don't know what's going to happen, but we know that there are some wonderful, amazing people over there who have huge choices to make in the next few decades. And it'll be very interesting to see what they come up with. But at the end of this war, really, against compassion, against altruism, against feminine values, against all that is feminine in our lives, who will win? You know, will it be women, or will it be the consumer society, the materialist, masculine-dominated, testosterone-driven, competitive society that we see right now? We really don't know. So I do want people to discuss it. And you're right, the narrator in this book is completely different from the lyrical narrator in What the Body Remembers. But that is part of the modern era. You know, it has to have a modern voice, not an elegiac tone, not a lyrical tone, because this is the reality of modern life that we're talking about. So yeah, it's pretty realist.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking today with Shauna Singh Baldwin. It has been a pleasure having you with us on Profiles on WFIU. Once again, this is Shumit Ganguly, your host.
Thank you so much.
The program you just heard was recorded in February of 2014. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. James Gray is the producer. The studio engineer and radio audio director is Michael Paskash. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.